Hello, Tom here. You've got the pleasure of hanging out with Karen and Becky for this episode. And while the quality of Becky's knowledge and chat is off the charts as usual, unfortunately, we had a bit of an issue with her mic, so the sound quality isn't quite up to that same level. Hopefully, you'll enjoy the pod nonetheless. It's an absolute banger.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to episode 5 of the TCR Daily podcast. So it's just Karen and Becky here this evening, and we're going to do our best to focus on some more of the stuff from the women in the race. Evening, Becky, how are you doing?
Really good, thank you, Karen. I'm looking forward to it just being us and going off script a little bit, maybe.
Lovely. So I guess what we're meant to do here is start off by having a think about the general shape of the race. How's it looking? Have you been following it much for the last 24 hours or so, Becky?
I have, yeah. It's been really exciting seeing the front runners coming towards the third control point. It's a familiar route from control point 2 to 3. It's very similar to 2016. And it was just nice to see the dots make their way across, and looking forward to seeing the photos of the riders as they get into Montenegro. I think for me, the photos from Dermator National Park were some of the best TCR photos.
Yeah, I haven't been to Montenegro. I've been to Albania, and yeah, it's definitely a part of the world where I would really love to go, and ideally on a bike. So yeah, I'm in a similar boat there. I'm really looking forward to seeing what happens, and I hear it's a pretty challenging route to get to the park or in the first place, so yeah, it feels like it's quite an important 24 hours lying in front of us for some of the riders at the front of the race maybe. So I think did we want to talk a bit about so we've seen I guess it's a familiar route more or less from control point 2 through to control point 3, so through from the Italian Alps through to Dermator in Montenegro. And I think if I'm right in saying this, we're also seeing a slightly similar pattern emerge in the different routes that people are taking. So I think there's been a pretty similar path that everyone seems to be taking from off the control point to parkour, kind of down out of the Alps and into the Po Valley, where I guess it's probably pretty hot and pretty flat right now, and then kind of cutting into Slovenia. And then once they get into Croatia, I think we're starting to see that's where there seems to be a bit of a split, with some riders kind of hugging to the coast and others heading off to the further inland, basically taking a kind of eastern route.
I think you're right. There seems to be two major options. One is very coastal, and then one is much further inland, going via Zagreb, it looks like, and only a handful of riders are taking that slightly more northern or eastern route, whereas most people are hugging the coast. And then within that southern route, there's some variation there as well.
Yeah, at the moment we've just got Cat 160 Pav just kind of sticking his neck out on his own over in Zagreb. But Becky, earlier you pointed out it looks like Fiona is possibly going to be heading out that way as well, so it's going to be really interesting to see how it all plays out.
It does. She's on the exact same trajectory as him, and I know she'd mentioned that she was going inland once she got to Croatia to avoid the coastal roads, which she suspected would be slower. I had a look at the 2016 dots earlier today, and not many people went that far north. As it stands on that southern route, Ulrich and Adam have slightly diverged a little bit, and Adam's gone a bit further north, which looks to be an imitation of Christoph Allegaert's route from 2016, and that was his winning route. So there's a good precedent there.
Do we know how much riders have taken into account the historical routes and track records in their planning?
I have no idea, but I'd imagine quite a lot, maybe for better or worse. it's kind of like finding an answer to a homework question online, but you don't actually know that the answer's right.
Yeah, yeah. Just because someone else has written it doesn't mean it's the right answer. Yeah.
Exactly. You could both be wrong.
So do we know, how's it looking in the women's race then, Becky?
It looks like Fiona, I mean, it's probably far too early to tell, but she's very comfortable as the leading woman. It doesn't look like anyone behind her has come close, and I suspect they won't. Given the gap that she's already built, it would take a large effort to close that gap. But Fiona's proven to us that she's not here for the women's race. She's here for the overall, and she's currently sitting in 13th place, which at this point in her inaugural race last year, she was leading. But I don't think that means much, given the way that she races so consistently and very metronomic, I think you'd say. There's a chance that her steadiness will pay dividends a bit further along in the race.
And she's also had a major setback, not forgetting she spent who knows how many hours retracing her steps, hunting round the area where she'd bivvied, looking for her wallet, looking for her tracker, going to the police station. I actually learned yesterday how she's been surviving without her wallet and money. She's apparently been getting people to give her cash and paying them via PayPal over her phone, which I think just goes to show, you know, she's not just a super strong rider. She's got the wherewithal. She's got the thinking on her feet, the kind of just resilience, which is in equal parts as important as spinning your legs relatively fast in this race.
Absolutely.
So yeah, it's great to see.
That's like racing on your wits, isn't it? And it really reminded me of something you might see in the early days of the Tour de France. But with slightly more sophisticated technology.
Bars. Yeah.
Imagine the photos we'd see of Fiona telling those stories. She'd be even more expressive. No, I think she's doing it very legally and by the book.
Yeah. Sorry, yeah, I was not making any accusations that Fiona was just thieving her way through Europe. And then we've got there's a good race following behind her, though. I think we've had a change of positions between Megan and Amrey since we last met, if I'm correct there.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right. And I think every podcast that we've had, we've talked about the women's race and it's been Fiona, Megan, Amrey. So this is the first time that we've seen a change in the top three of the women. And I think we've mentioned it every podcast and we'll mention it on every other one. Amrey is one of the recipients of the Mike Hall bursary. And to see her not only sitting second overall, but I think you pointed out second woman and 27th overall is brilliant.
And actually making massive gains in her places. Just looking at coming through control point two, she came through 27th, but that was an increase. She'd gained 15 places since control point one. And I think what you often see in these races, it's not always about being first through the first control point. In fact, it rarely is about that. Slow burners, don't burn yourself out too quickly. And I think we're possibly seeing a bit of burnout, or at least some slowing down of the front of the men's race.
Definitely. I was just going to say, it's a bit of a myth, but it's often well proven, is that you do see the men start relatively fast and the women either will start at the pace they continue or might even speed up towards the end. And I suspect we may see Fiona, Amrey and Megan move a little bit further up the overall every day.
That's where I'd put my money.
Yeah, Yeah. And if we don't win our money, we'll go looting bars across Europe.
Exactly. So it's all good. And I think they might be the only three women through control point. Oh, no, I'm wrong. Christine Camera is also through control point two. Right. And then I think behind her, we've maybe got Lizzie Jenkins, who I think is still in Austria. So probably at control point three tomorrow.
You just forget the scale of the race. We've just talked about some riders almost making their way in, or they've just made their way into Bosnia, and then talking about another person in the same race being in Austria.
It happens so quickly, doesn't it? But just zooming out on the map, actually, it is amazing when you think, you know, there are quite a lot of people through control point two now, but looking at the map, the vast majority are still really way off getting through control point two. So it's just the kind of the huge variation in speed, but also the kind of huge variation in approaches and philosophies that people are bringing to the race and what they want to get out of it.
And they may arguably get more if you're out there for longer, right?
Yeah. Certainly a different experience. I don't know what you how you found it, Becky, but for me, when I did TCR, it really left me with a taste of all these amazing countries that I had blinked and passed through, and I would dearly love to go back to and actually enjoy my time there and, you know, spend time sitting and enjoying where I am, and maybe, heaven forfend, having a conversation with someone and finding out a bit more about the place. So I think those guys a bit further back are probably able to do a lot more of that, and I think for me that's a equally as important part of the TCR, if not more important.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think typically the faster you go, the more you learn about yourself, but the slower you go, the more you learn about the area around you and the people. So it's interesting to see how different an experience riders will have depending on where they are in the race and, like you say, their approach to the race.
I like it. And what do we know? I guess we probably need to speak a bit about the front of the race. We've alluded to it a bit. How are things looking there now?
It's hard to tell. We mentioned about those different route options coming out of the second control point and heading into the Balkans. And it looks like Ulrich or Adam are leading. But I'm not willing to put my name next to a bet on which one. So I'll probably be proven wrong once they get to control point three. Otherwise, we did see one rider who looks to have slipped back a little bit is Robin. He came in third to the second control point, and he still looks to be about fourth, did we say? Maybe fifth?
Yeah, we reckon he's maybe about fifth now, but he came in third to the second control point, but then overtook Ulrich and Adam, who were sleeping there. So was in first for quite a lot of yesterday and seems to have had quite a dramatic slip back. We don't know too much what that's about, whether he's popped, whether he's having an epic sleep, but we've had some intel coming through via text that there's a bit of an Arsch Fleischwunder problem for those German speakers out there.
And if you're not German, you could probably understand anyway. It looks like saddle sores have been rife through the pack, though. I remember in 2019, they hit riders quite hard because we were obviously starting in the hottest country, or the hotter countries, and you then do a lot of damage early on, whereas in this point of the race, riders are starting to develop those saddle sores. And one rider who, a friend of mine who's been putting on her Instagram about her peach update is Wendy Ellis. She made it to check the first control point, I think midnight, not last night, but the night before. I'm going to do a shameless plug here. She is one half of Turning the Cogs. The other half, Hetty Kingston,
no shame.
Was
there's
in.
No shame.
No shame. Yeah, shameful. But she is one half of Turning the Cogs, and the other half is Hetty Kingston, who was in the pre-race podcast with Tom. And in case anyone missed it, Turning the Cogs is a data-led research project that's aiming to increase the diversity of start lines of bike races. So if you haven't already filled in the questionnaire, you can head to the Turning the Cogs website and fill that in. And there'll be plenty of replies for Wendy when she finishes in Burgas in a couple of days.
Yeah, I'd really encourage everyone to go to their website. I'm just on it now, and I enjoy how they describe who their survey is for. So they say, we particularly want to hear from people who are part of an underrepresented area of cycling. Hint, if you're asking yourself if you're underrepresented, it's probably not you. So yeah. There you go.
That's a heavy hint.
Yeah.
You did mention a little bit about a pair. The leading pair is Stefan Wager and Theo Daniel.
Yes, so that's 252 A and B. So they still seem to be in the lead of the pairs. We've heard a rumour they might have had a bit of a falling out, but they still seem to be riding together based on where their dots are currently, unless we're misreading things. So maybe there's more on that to follow. And they're still being tailed by the Gates father and son duo. But there does seem to have been a bit of a gap that's opened up between them now.
Yeah, Stefan and Theo are the only ones who've made it to the second control point, right? Whereas yes. Sam and Richard are just starting the parkour, did we say?
Yeah, so it looks like they're just in, is it Bormio at the beginning of the parkour? And there's actually quite a cluster of riders there. And given that it's probably, you know, it's coming up to midnight in Italy now as we speak. So we think there's probably quite a lot of them that are bedding down for the night in Bormio tonight and planning to ride the parkour in the morning. And we know from riders coming through yesterday that it can be really cold up on that pass. So yeah, I reckon a lot of the riders will be stopping there and then doing the parkour first thing in the morning.
Yeah, I wonder if they've heard the podcast.
Maybe, yeah, maybe. Mm. And also shout out for any riders listening. If you've got any questions or comments, you know, we're looking for some intelligence feeds, so do send in your updates.
Definitely. It'd be brilliant to have some information from the riders. And a couple of questions for the riders would be awesome.
Yeah. And can we maybe even do, if anyone's up for doing an interview on the road, I'm sure we can get the media car on it.
Yeah. We'll just click our fingers and send Tom back from Montenegro to Austria.
Yeah, you're not doing enough travelling, Tom. So yeah, get back in the car, please. Should we do a quick scratch report?
Yeah, there's not a lot to report, which is good.
Which
news,
is great.
Right?
Mm. Yeah. We had a lot of scratches to report on yesterday. But
do you think it's to do with where they are in the race relative to the control points?
Yeah, it's interesting. It may also have been, I think last time we recorded, it had maybe been a day and a half between recordings. So there was more time for people to scratch.
True.
This time it's been 24 hours. There's True. Probably also, as you say, the kind of psychological barrier maybe. I actually don't know where a lot of the scratches from last time scratched. Was it a really early scratch? I know Rob was saying a couple of days ago it's kind of typically it's the kind of control point two, control point three area where people tend to scratch because you're really far in, your body's starting to wear down, it's been a long time on the road, but you've still got a really flipping far way to go to get to the
yes.
end. And it's still
yes.
at the point where it's relatively easy if you're from Western Europe where a lot of the riders are. Still relatively easy to get home, whereas the further east you go, for most people that tends to be heading away from where they live and therefore more difficult for them to get home, and the motivation and the drive to get to the finish increases because actually A, you're closer to the finish, so it's encouraging, but B, it's probably your easiest way to get home eventually.
Oh, absolutely, especially if you've got some transport home from Burgas booked. Getting out of Eastern Europe can be just as hard or even harder than just carrying on following plan A.
Yeah.
Just going to speculate and say,
speculate
given
away.
It's what we're here for, right? how few riders relatively have made it past the second control point. There are so many who look like they've just come out of Czech Republic into Germany and a few in Austria. And we may see a good amount of riders scratch as they get to the second checkpoint, because there's a big change in direction when you've come south and you start heading, it's not quite due east, but it's like you say, away from home.
Do you think there's also the I guess once you've got to the second control point, you've really started to do a lot of elevation, you've hit some big mountains, it's probably the point where those kind of repetitive injuries that come through overuse, and especially riding on a heavy bike where you're just putting different kinds of forces through your body that it may not be used to for everyone. I guess that's also a kind of the first point where maybe injury-based scratching as opposed to bike-based scratching, or you know, psychology-based scratching might start to play into things.
And we've even seen some K-tape on Ulrich, haven't we, which I don't think he started with. He's been complaining of some knee pain, which I've heard some people say may have been overtraining, because it's an unusual injury for someone who's so experienced to pick up, and he potentially didn't come in quite as well rested as he may have needed to.
Interesting. Yeah, I've heard he had posted saying that he was riding one-legged for part of today, which I think apparently he's known for doing. He's done it before in Two Volcano Sprint, I think, but that was right at the end, whereas this does feel a little ominously early to be taking to that. Those
he's doing better with one leg than we did with both of ours.
Yeah.
That's embarrassing. He could have kept that information to himself.
Yeah. Yeah, so just quickly then, in terms of the scratch report, we've had three scratches. So we've had Peter Woodward Court, Cap 189, Tom Clays, Cap 211, and then also half of the 259 pair, Gary Cunnington.
Something that I picked up on Instagram was a post from Follow My Challenge, and they have collated, I believe it was 20,000 waypoints of all the riders into one image, and so far all most riders have made it to the first control point, many have made it to the second control point, and these control points act as effectively mandatory pinch points in this visualization of all the dots. And to me it looked like this accordion of the dots, and you can see they diverge out of Radersbergen, converge back again into the first control point, and then diverge again, and then converge again. And it just allows people to travel apart naturally on their own routes, and then brings them back together again for the control points. And I can't remember seeing such a good visualization of exactly what a free route is and how exciting it could be to follow them.
Yeah, it was amazing to see that divergence from so early on. And there's just, when you're looking at that that image, I'd really encourage people to go and look it up. It's at FM Challenge on Instagram. Yeah, it's really cool. There's just this gaping hole in the middle that the two divergences of the route have gone around. And yeah, it's really striking. And it's exciting to think about what's going to happen, you know, after control point two. There's just kind of a very thin line, because only a few people have ridden it so far and they've all taken a very similar route. But yeah, it's really impressive to see.
Yeah, I definitely recommend it.
Do you know they're updating it? Presumably they're updating it as the race continues.
It's, as far as I know, it's not a live photo, but maybe if we make a big deal of it on the podcast, they'll release a few more every day, maybe. The next thing on the agenda, I guess, is the listener questions, which we love, and we would like you to all send as many as possible. The first one comes from Tom Summerfield in Berlin. And his first question is, do the riders lock their bikes while buying food at a petrol station or in the supermarket? And if not, then it'd be interesting to hear what other solutions they have to secure their bikes. And it reminded me of something, I'm sure I read it on someone's Twitter from a TCR a couple of years ago. And in that very dry TCR mid-race sense of humour, they tweeted and said, the biggest difference between racing and touring is that when you're touring, you don't want someone to nick your bike when you go into a supermarket. And it's just so true. The number of times you walk out of a supermarket, and you just go, oh God, it's still there. Why has
absolutely
no one nicked
spot
it?
On. So good. Oh, maybe I'll just, oh, that it looks really busy around there. I'll just leave my bike there. Hopefully someone will have it.
Yeah.
Then the ordeal will end.
Yeah, I had to scratch. I didn't have a bike.
Yeah. So I don't know about you, Becky, but I did actually lug a bike a lot round with me when I did TCR. It wasn't, you know, like a big D-lock or a chain lock or anything like that, obviously, but it also wasn't one of those really tiny cafe locks, which I'm sure a fair few people do carry because it's basically zero weight. I had a kind of a mid-weight one that just kind of flopped around on the back of my saddlebag. I think I used it once on the first day and then basically never used it again, but I did just continue carrying it around. And it just was too faffy. It was just too faffy to take it off. Yeah, it was a really useful extra thing to hook like jerseys off. It was like an extra,
it's a clothesline.
Kind of addition. Yeah, yes, exactly. You could like tuck it into the saddlebag straps and then you could like hook your spare. I also had two pairs of socks. I was very luxurious. Had two pairs of bibs and two pairs of socks. So I'd kind of hang my laundry, wrap it around it off the back of my saddlebag. Exactly. So, but I stopped using it at all because it was too much faff to take it off because I was using it as my clothesline. But also I think in the back of my mind, there was exactly what you've said, Becky. I was just kind of quietly hoping someone would quietly take my bike away from me whilst I was in Lidl loading up.
That's exactly it. Yeah, and they're all such beautiful bikes. Why would no one want them?
Probably because they absolutely stink.
Yeah. They've got 4,000 kilometres of work on them.
Covered in all sorts of grime and, yeah.
The second question I'll pitch to you, which is actually a really good, very practical question that potentially isn't talked about enough. Is approximately how much money do the riders spend on food and drink on a typical TCR day? Maybe we don't include Switzerland in this because that could bankrupt you in a day.
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I'm not sure I know what the answer to that is. I think probably, as I feel we've said to a lot of the questions so far, it's going to be pretty dependent on the person. I think, you know, some people do like to stop and have a proper meal in a restaurant, sit down, enjoy the journey, have a beer, have a nice coffee, all of that stuff. Whereas others will be much more kind of smash and grab approach, you know, just having packet sandwiches, chocolate bars, whatever you can grab from a supermarket or a corner store quickly. So I don't know. I would say obviously you're consuming a lot more food and drink than you would usually if you're just going about your daily life, just the number of calories you need to get into your body to ride 300 odd kilometers, if not more, or maybe a little bit less depending on who you are. But no matter how where you are in the pack, you're riding a lot of kilometers a day and you need a lot of calories in you. Obviously you can be getting calories on the cheap or you can be splashing out and enjoying your restaurant meals. So I really couldn't call it on that, but I think it's the food and drink stuff is probably the smallest of the kind of expenses for TCR. I think it's a lot more about the bike, the travel to and from the start, the staying in hotels, if that's what you're doing. Whereas food, you can pick that up as you go. And I think the further into the race you get, typically the further from Western Europe you get, the cheaper that food is going to be as well. So your daily costs will go down. I don't know, Becky, have you got a sense for how much?
the riders are getting into the cheaper lands, and we might see a few more hotels now. You can pick up a room for a lot less, and it's probably at the point where the riders need it a bit more, especially if it's hot.
Yeah, I mean, you need a big ice cream budget, that's for sure.
Oh, absolutely. Matt Faulkner's probably been saving for a couple of years for this.
Use his icer on it. So I'm sorry, we've definitely not given you a straight answer there, Tom. But yeah, hopefully that helps a bit. Interested if there are any veterans out there that have ridden the TCR and have a good sense of how much they spent, I'd actually be interested to know that. We've got another question also from Germany, from Marika in Germany. She says, hello there. A couple of questions. So firstly, what are the benefits of riding the TCR as a pair, other than having mental support and somebody to talk to?
I messaged a couple of mates about this, actually. I believe Tom did the last TCR in a pair, but he's not here, so maybe he could chip in. But generally what the friends I talked to said was that when it's going well, it can really work. And it's unlikely that you're going to sink in terms of morale and sleep strategies. So when one person is kind of on an up, they can really bring the other person up. And you effectively have a teammate, right? And if in those moments where, as a solo rider, you're a bit low and you only have your own thoughts, in a pair, you've got someone who's on your team who wants you and them collectively to do well. So I think when it works, a pair can be a really good thing. But there are reasons that we've very rarely seen pairs win these races. I can only think of one race, which was across Andes in 2019. And there's no other race I can think of where a pair has outright won the race, because there are a long list of disadvantages.
We actually weren't asked about the disadvantages, so maybe we don't even go there. But just to add in, if we do go there, to add into the thing, one more thing about the benefits. Yeah, there's definitely that kind of that psychological side, but also there's the very kind of physical and physiological side of having someone to draft with, and that essentially makes you, if you're riding well together, you're more efficient, you're using less energy to cover the same ground, and that can make a huge difference. But I think, you know, as Becky, as you've said, it seems like often the disadvantages of riding in a pair outweigh the advantages in terms of speed, but maybe not in terms of enjoyment of the ride or all these other things.
Yes, and there are so many different relationships that pairs have. They may be friends, often they're romantic partners, and occasionally, like Richard and Sam, we see a father and son pair. I can't think of a mother and daughter pair, but hopefully we'll see one soon.
Would like to see it happen.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess it depends on their relationship as well. Some friends may admit that they might not speak to this person for a couple of weeks after if they're great on each other. But if you're in a romantic relationship, you may live together, you may have a family together. You don't really have that luxury. You're going to have to get on because there's a lot riding on it.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. A pretty intense experience, I would imagine, riding in a pair. I think a lot of veterans, when you ask if they'd consider riding in a pair, kind of have a bit of a knee-jerk, oh gosh, no, kind of a reaction, because I think it is a lot to be in those kinds of mental and physical states that you go through and have someone else that you need to present well to, someone else who's there when you're having a strop on the side of the road.
Yeah,
sometimes it's maybe easier when you're on your own, when you have those moments, either because no one sees you Or actually, I think there's also something about when you're on your own, there's no one to see you. So there's no point having a strop. There's no point having a cry.
Exactly.
There's no point giving up because no one cares. No one's there to help you. So you've just got to get on with it. And I think there is something, I see it in myself. If I know there's no one to help me, I don't complain. I just get on with it and sort it out. If there's someone else, I feel I let my guard down. You know, maybe I'll just be a bit more pathetic about the situation, basically. So, yeah.
I know. I totally agree with you. We have seen, I think, a couple of solo riders or people who've traditionally raced solo have looked to ride in a pair just for a different experience. So I think we saw it at Tuvok in a sprint last year where Sofyan Sahili and Adrian Laikti rode in a pair, and they're race winners in their own right, but they just went to experience a race in a different way. And I think they did admit to themselves that they would be less competitive together than they would be separately.
Tom, we're looking forward to you zooming in from the future to give us your take on this.
Okay then, well, I've got a couple of things to add to all of those great points that you've already made. I rode as a pair in 2019 with my friend Adrian, and there's quite a lot of practical advantages to doing it as well. And it's mainly to do with like sharing the load of all the logistics that you have to do. So you can effectively kind of multitask if you get organized enough. So, I mean, even in the preparation for the race, we split up the route planning, which, you know, just means that you can break up this huge task of planning a 4,000 kilometer route into two. And even that's still quite a big job, but you know, you can't underestimate how much time it takes to plan out a route on that scale. So and then things like, and this sort of links back to when you were talking about people bringing locks, we didn't have to bring a lock because when you go into a shop, there's always one person who can stand outside and look after the bikes. And then what they can also do at that point, which is a bit of dead time, is just attend to some other logistical stuff they have to do. So they could be putting on some sun cream or, you know, checking the tracker to get some information or booking a hotel. On a slightly more superficial level, you've got someone to take photos of you. I think a lot of people probably come back from TCR with an album of photos of an empty bike kind of propped up against scenic backdrops or hundreds of selfies, so you get a slightly more interesting and diverse body of photos to look back on and reminisce about once the ordeal's over. And then you have this kind of built-in redundancy of kit as well. So like if one of your GPS units fails, you've always got another one. And so there's a certain amount of things where you've doubled up because you're in a pair that you could just use one of if one of them fails. So that means that each person doesn't necessarily have to bring backups of everything. So each rider could potentially be slightly more lightweight. And then you can kind of also play to each other's strengths in certain situations if you need to. So there was one point where we'd booked a hotel and it was getting into the, well, quite late at night really. And they'd given us a hard deadline to arrive and they said they were going to close if we didn't get there by that time. And we were getting quite close to that, you know, we were kind of slipping back in our schedule, getting quite close to that cutoff time. And we still had Col de Telegraph to get over. So I left some of my heavier stuff with Adrian, which, you know, as far as I remember, he consented to. And then just set off as fast as I could to try and sprint over this hill and try and get down, back down into the town, which was on the other side, in time before the hotel closed. So I arrived and checked in, and then I could kind of get things charging and do all the sort of logistics that you need to do when you arrive in a hotel room. And then in the meantime, while I was doing that, Adrian was able to grab some food for both of us and potentially a beer. And then he kind of arrived like an hour later, and I hadn't had to try and work out getting food on top of everything else. So that's a really big advantage, I think, that you, if you think about it and plan it out properly, you can share all of the workload, which is surprisingly a lot. There's a lot of logistical stuff to kind of work out on the race. You can share that load between the two of you. Great job on the pod, by the way.
Should we move on to the last question then? Maybe could Karen and Becky share some of their feelings after the race? So how long did it take to recover, not only physically but emotionally, given that they raced through many different countries in a very short period of time? It must be overwhelming to experience so much during a few days, the different landscapes, the different peoples along the way, all the obstacles they had to overcome, the mix of feelings during the race and so on. That's a really great question. Several questions.
I think yes, one big question. And it's something that you even mentioned that you were looking forward to answering, because it's not something that's really talked about enough. When you talk about all the energy that goes into the transcontinental, you're often talking about the preparation, and then the ride itself. And I think we forget quite how much of an undertaking this is and how hard it can be to, you often hear people say, to just drop back into real life. And especially if you have a traditional work and job, and you've just spent however long riding across a continent, you drop back into an office or a workplace around your colleagues and they don't understand, and perhaps your partner doesn't understand, and you suddenly feel like you've had this big raw experience that you can't quite process, or it just takes a long time to process it.
Yeah, and I think it's not just that you've had a really intense 2-week race, it's that you've probably had a really intense 8 months because for a lot of people, all the route planning, the trying to get your bike sorted, the worry, the trying to get yourself physically sorted, everything feels so geared up to doing this big epic ride, and then you're doing the ride and then it stops, and you can feel a bit, I know quite a lot of people feel quite essentially a bit rudderless after the race, because they're kind of thing that's been basically dominating how they've planned their lives and been thinking about things for the last half a year or so is suddenly not there. So I know for a lot of people it's really challenging emotionally. On the other hand, I think a lot of people also come away just really invigorated and with this kind of sense of strength and excitement at the world and kind of increased confidence in what they can do and all of this stuff, which for me is something that I massively gained from riding the TCR. And I don't think you can easily lose that kind of thing. Just the number of stuff that everyone inevitably, if you've completed the TCR, if you've even ridden half of it, you've no doubt had loads of unpredictable, weird stuff thrown at you that you have managed to overcome. I think just the kind of strength and resilience that you can take from that is huge. On the kind of physical side of things, this is where I think, again, it's maybe a bit more so now, but I think it's also not fully, it's not talked about very much, and it's also just maybe not understood super well. Like, a lot of people talk about needing to have just a lot of time on the sofa when they get back. People talk about riding and it feels like their bike's just got flat tires all the time, like there's just nothing coming out of the legs. And I think, you know, some people, probably depending on physiology but also levels of fitness and training, some people seem to spring back relatively well, whereas others take a really long time. For me, it was crazy to hear that Ben Davies was going to be riding this after doing Trans Am. I know that I was good for nothing for a couple of months after TCR, but everyone's different, and I think it's really important that people kind of give themselves space and permission to just actually genuinely do nothing after this, because you see photos of people on the start line and people on the finish line, like they've put their bodies through so much. People lose a lot of weight from the exertion, from the dehydration. Like, you really need to take recovery very seriously after this kind of event, I think. And I, less so after TCR, but after doing another, I did the Transatlantic Way in the following year, so in 2018. And I think I was essentially trying to do too much around it. I was super busy at work. I was doing a bit of road racing. I was doing a bit of cyclocross. And I just popped. And it took me a couple of years to get back into things. And it may have been doing too much, but it may have also been post-viral fatigue. I don't know what it was, but I hear other similar stories, and I think there's really something in this that, like, it can really deplete your reserves, and if you're not putting other things in place to make sure you recover properly, you can have really kind of run yourself into a hole that's quite tricky to get out of.
Your point about giving yourself permission is really important, because they're enormous undertakings. And you're right, you should allow yourself, when you look at all the hard work that you put in beforehand, if you can treat recovery the same and take it as seriously as and importantly, and as much of the process as the prep, then I think that'll go a long way. I did message James Hayden about this actually and asked what he thought, because he's done TCR a couple of times, had different experiences. He scratched once, finished fourth, and then won it twice. And he was saying how long it takes you to recover can depend on depend on the outcome. So if you have a good performance, it can be easy to recover fast mentally. Whereas if you're disappointed or you're not so happy with your performance, that's a whole other layer to processing what you've just done. So I think a phrase I heard recently was that hopes and expectations are a terrible way to measure an outcome. And if you go in with, I wouldn't say low expectations, but an achievable idea of what you can get out of it. And if you say, well, I'm going to cross a continent and I'm going to learn something about myself or the area, then you're probably not going to be disappointed. But if you do go in with a goal of a certain position or a time, then you're almost setting yourself up to be disappointed.
Yeah, that's super interesting. And yeah, how the kind of, yeah, just psychology is so important in this kind of stuff, and how you approach something and the impact on both your kind of emotional and physical recovery. Yeah,
big question.
And on that note, we've probably better wrap it up. So I guess this is what Tom usually does, but I guess we'll be back probably tomorrow, maybe the next day, some permutation of Tom, Becky, Rob and me. Thanks for listening, and
thank you so much, guys.
For joining.
Thank you very much for having me, and this has been brilliant. Wish you kick Tom and Rob out more often.
Yeah, we don't need them. Yeah, it's fine. All right, and I should just to remind everyone, you can send in your questions about the TCR for the upcoming episode. So if you've got any questions, send them in to race@transcontinental.cc with pod question as the subject. Awesome. Thanks everyone for listening. And yeah, we'll see you back here tomorrow.
Thank you everyone.
Bye.
Bye.
This podcast is supported by our race partners, Apidura, Physique, Hutchinson, Kinesis, Komoot, LEM Helmets, and Pedaled. All the music has been created for this series by Joe Skinner.